abundant methods. He knew that not everyone is able to understand ultimate truths right from the start. It's difficult for many of us to process concepts such as hell is merely the perception of your own aggression, let alone the concept of emptiness. Buddha doesn't want Jack to be caught in a personal hell, but he can't tell Jack to work with his perceptions and aggression either because Jack is an idiot. So for Jack's sake, Buddha teaches that there is an external hell, and that in order to avoid going there and being boiled in molten iron, Jack must stop entertaining his non-virtuous negative actions and emotions. Such teachings pervade the Buddhist milieu. Very often we see hell realms painted on the walls of Buddhist temples, complete with burning bodies and terrifying gorges of frigid water. These images can be taken literally or figuratively, depending on the capacity of the student. Those with superior faculties know that the source of our everyday hell, our suffering, stems from our own perceptions. They know that there is no judgment day and there's no judge. When Milarepa appeared in the Yakhorn, Rechungpa was on his way to becoming a great master himself. He had an enormous capacity to understand emptiness intellectually and enough realization to actually see Milarepa in the Yakhorn, but his realization stopped just short of being able to join his master. Buddha's final aim is to make Jack understand, like these superior students, that there is no hell realm apart from his own aggression and ignorance. By temporarily minimizing his negative actions, Jack is diverted from becoming more entangled with his perceptions, misgivings, and paranoia. The word karma is practically synonymous with Buddhism. It is usually understood as a sort of moralistic system of retribution, bad karma and good karma. But karma is simply a law of cause and effect, not to be confused with morality or ethics. No one, including Buddha, set the fundamental bar for what is negative and what is positive. Any motivation and action that steer us away from such truths as all compounded things are impermanent can result in negative consequences or bad karma. Any action that brings us closer to understanding such truths as all emotions are pain can result in positive consequences or good karma. At the end of the day, it was not for Buddha to judge. Only you can truly know the motivation behind your actions. In a discussion with his disciple Subhuti, Siddhartha said, "Those who see Buddha as a form and those who hear Buddha as a sound have the wrong view." 400 years later, the great Indian Buddhist scholar Nagarjuna concurred. In his famous treatise on Buddhist philosophy, he devoted an entire chapter to analyzing the Buddha and concluded that ultimately there is no externally existing Buddha. Even today, it is not unusual to hear Buddhists saying such as, "If you see Buddha on the road, kill him." This is, of course, meant figuratively. Certainly, one should not kill him. It means that the real Buddha is not an externally existing savior bound by time and space. On the other hand, a man named Siddhartha did appear on this earth, who became known as Gautama Buddha, and walked barefoot on the streets of Magadha, begging alms. This Buddha gave sermons, nursed the sick, and even visited his family in Kapilavastu. The reason Buddhists will not dispute that this physical Buddha existed in the 5th century BCE in India, as opposed to modern-day Croatia, for example, is that we have historical records that for centuries he has served as a source of inspiration in India. He was a great teacher, the first in a long line of learned masters and disciples. It is nothing more than that. Yet, for a serious seeker, inspiration is everything. Siddhartha used many skillful methods to inspire people. One day, a monk noticed a tear in Gautama Buddha's robe and offered to stitch it, but Buddha refused his offer. He kept walking and begging alms in his torn robe. When he headed toward the hideout of a destitute woman, the monks were puzzled because they knew that she had no alms to offer. When she saw his torn robe, the woman offered to mend it with what little string she had. Siddhartha accepted and declared that her virtue would allow her to be reborn in her next life as a queen of the heavens. Many people who heard this story were inspired to acts of generosity of their own. In another story, Siddhartha cautioned a butcher that killing generated negative karma. But the butcher said, "This is all I know. It is my livelihood." Siddhartha told the butcher to at least take a vow not to kill from sunset to sunrise. He was not giving permission for the butcher to kill during the daytime, but was guiding him to gradually minimize his unwholesome actions. These are examples of the skillful means that Buddha employed to teach the Dharma. He was not saying that because the poor woman stitched his robe, she was going to heaven, as if he were divine. It was her own generosity that caused her good fortune. You might think that this is a paradox. Buddha contradicts himself, saying that he doesn't exist, that everything is emptiness, and then teaching morality and salvation. But these methods are necessary in order not to scare people who are not ready to be introduced to emptiness. They are pacified and made ready for the real teachings. It is like saying that there is a snake and throwing the tie out the window. These infinite methods are the path. However, the path itself must eventually be abandoned, just as you abandon a boat when you reach the other shore. You must disembark once you have arrived. At the point of total realization, you must abandon Buddhism. The spiritual path is a temporary solution, a placebo to be used until emptiness is understood. The benefits of understanding. You may still ponder, what is the benefit of understanding emptiness? By understanding emptiness, you maintain an appreciation for all that appears to exist, but without clinging to the illusions as if they were real, and without the incessant disappointment of a child chasing a rainbow. You see through the illusions and are reminded that it is the self that created them in the first place. You may still get stirred up or emotional, sad, angry, or passionate, but you have the confidence of someone at the cinema who can leave the drama behind because there's a clear understanding that it's just a movie. Your hopes and fears are at least slightly diffused, like recognizing that the snake is just a tie. When we have not realized emptiness, when we don't fully understand that all things are illusions, the world seems real, tangible, and solid. Our hopes and fears also become solid and thus uncontrollable. For example, if you have a solid belief in your family, you have a deep-seated expectation that your parents will take care of you. You don't feel that way about a stranger on the street. He has no such obligation. Understanding assembled phenomena and understanding emptiness allow for some room in the relationship. As you begin to see the various experiences, pressures, and circumstances that molded your parents, your expectations of them change, your disappointment lessens. When some of us become parents ourselves, even a little understanding of interdependence effectively softens our expectations of our children, which they may interpret as love. Without that understanding, we might have good intentions to love and care for our children, but our expectations and demands can become unbearable. Similarly, by understanding emptiness, you lose interest in all the trappings and beliefs that society builds up and tears down. Political systems, science and technology, global economy, free society, the United Nations. You become like an adult who is not so interested in children's games. For so many years you have trusted these institutions and believed that they could succeed where past systems have failed. But the world has not yet become safer, more pleasant, securer. This is not to say that you should drop out of society. Having an understanding of emptiness doesn't mean that you become blasé. To the contrary, you develop a feeling of responsibility and compassion. If Jack is howling, making a scene, yelling at everyone to stop putting snakes in the house, and you know it is because of his delusion, you have sympathy for him. Others may not be so forgiving, so you can try turning on some lights for Jack's sake. On a gross level, you will still fight for your individual rights, hold down a job, be politically active within the system, but when the situation changes, either for you or against you, you're prepared. You don't blindly believe that everything you wish for and expect must materialize, and you're not caught up in the end result. More often than not, many of us choose to stay in the dark. We aren't able to see the illusions that create our everyday life because we don't have the courage to break out of the network that we're plugged into. We think that we are, or will soon be, comfortable enough if we continue on as we are going. It's as if we are entering a maze through which we already have a habitual route, and we don't want to explore other directions. We are not adventurous because we think we have so much to lose. We fear that if we see the world from the view of emptiness, we may be cast out from society, lose our respectability, and along with it, our friends, family, and job. The seductive allure of the illusory world doesn't help. It's packaged so well. We're bombarded with messages about soap that makes us smell like heaven, how miraculous the South Beach diet is, how democracy is the only viable system of government, how vitamins will increase our stamina. We rarely hear more than one side of the truth, and on the rare occasions that we do, it's usually in fine print. Imagine George W. Bush going to Iraq and proclaiming, "American-style democracy might or might not work in your country." Like a child at the cinema, we get caught up in the illusion. From this comes all of our vanity, ambition, and insecurity. We fall in love with the illusions we've created and develop excessive pride in our appearance, our possessions, and our accomplishments. It's like wearing a mask and proudly thinking that the mask is really you. Once there were 500 monkeys, one of whom thought he was very clever. One night, this monkey saw the reflection of the moon in the lake. He proudly informed all the other monkeys, "If we go to the lake and collect the moon, then we will be the heroes who save the moon." At first, the other monkeys didn't believe him. But when they saw with their own eyes that the moon had fallen into the lake, they decided to try to save it. They climbed a tree and held each other by the tail so they could reach the shimmering moon. Just as the last monkey was about to grab the moon, the branch broke and they all fell in the lake. They didn't know how to swim, and they all struggled in the water as the image of the moon shattered in the ripples. Driven by the hunger for fame and originality, we are like these monkeys, thinking that we are so clever in discovering things and convincing our fellow humans to see what we see, think what we think, driven by ambition to be the savior, the clever one, the seer of all. We have all kinds of small ambitions, such as impressing a girl, or big ambitions, such as landing on Mars. And time after time, we end up in the water with nothing to hold on to and not knowing how to swim. Having understood emptiness, Siddhartha had no preference whether he lay on the kusha grass beneath the Bodhi tree or on silk cushions in the palace. The higher value placed on golden-threaded cushions is completely fabricated by human ambition and desire. In fact, a mountain hermit might find the kusha grass more soothing and clean, and best of all, If it gets worn out, there is no worry. You don't have to spray it with repellent to prevent your cats from digging their claws into it. Palace life is filled with such precious items that require maintenance. But if forced to make a choice, Siddhartha would choose the grass mat so he wouldn't have much to maintain. We humans consider broad-mindedness to be a virtue. In order to broaden our minds, it's important not to settle merely for what makes us comfortable and what we're used to. It helps if we have the courage to go beyond the norms and not get stuck within the usual boundaries of logic. If we can go beyond the boundaries, we will realize that emptiness is ridiculously simple. Milarepa taking shelter inside the yak horn will be no more surprising than someone putting on a pair of gloves. The challenge lies in our attachment to using the same old logic, grammar, alphabet, and numerical equations. If we can remember the compounded nature of these habits, we can cut through them. They are not impossible to break. All it takes is one situation when the conditions are precisely right and one piece of timely information is provided. Then you may suddenly realize that all the tools you rely on are not so rigid. They are elastic, bendable. Your point of view will change. If someone you trust tells you that the wife that you've been resenting all these years is actually a goddess of wealth in disguise, then how you look at her will change in every way. Similarly, if you're enjoying a delicious steak with all kinds of sauces at a nice restaurant, savoring every bite, and then the chef tells you it is actually human flesh, instantly the experience changes 180 degrees. Your concept of delicious becomes a concept of revolting. When you wake up from a dream about 500 elephants, you aren't puzzled about how the elephants were able to fit into your room because they didn't exist before, during, or after the dream. Yet, when you were dreaming about them, they were perfectly real. One day, we will realize, not just intellectually, that there's no such thing as big and small, gain or loss, that it is all relative. Then we will be able to understand how Milarepa fit inside the yak horn and why a tyrant like King Ashoka bowed down and submitted to this truth. Chapter 4. Nirvana is beyond concepts. According to Buddhists, before this life in which he attained enlightenment, Siddhartha lived countless lives as birds, monkeys, elephants, kings, queens, and many as a bodhisattva, a being whose sole aim is to overcome ignorance in order to benefit all beings. But it was in his lifetime as the Indian prince Siddhartha that he at long last defeated Mara beneath the Bodhi tree and finally reached the other shore, the other side of samsara. This state is referred to as nirvana. Having reached nirvana, he gave his first sermon in Sarnath near Varanasi and continued to teach throughout northern India for the rest of his long life. His students were monks and nuns, kings and warlords, courtesans and merchants. Many members of his family became renunciants, including his wife Yashodhara and his son Rahula. He was venerated as a supreme being by many people from all over India and beyond, but he did not become immortal. After a long life of teaching, he passed away in a place called Kushinagar. At that moment, he went even beyond nirvana to a state that is called paranirvana. Heaven, the ultimate vacation. Nirvana, enlightenment, liberation, freedom, heaven. These are words that many people like to utter and few have time to examine. How would it be to enter into one of these states? Even though we may think that nirvana is far different from heaven, our versions of heaven and nirvana have roughly the same characteristics. Heaven/nirvana is where we go when we die after many years of paying dues, doing practice, and being good citizens. We will meet many of our old comrades because it's a place where all the good dead people gather, while all the not-so-good dead people suffer down below. We finally have a chance to solve life's mysteries, finish unfinished business, make amends, and maybe see into our past lives. Small babies without sex organs fly around doing our ironing. Our dwelling meets our every need and desire and is well situated in a community of other nirvana dwellers who obey the rules. We never have to lock the windows and doors, and there is probably no need for police. If there are politicians, they are all reliable and honest. Everything is exactly to our liking. It's like a very pleasant retirement home. Or perhaps some of us imagine the purest of pure white light, spaciousness, rainbows, and clouds upon which we rest in a blissful state, practicing our powers of clairvoyance and omniscience. There is no death to fear because you're already dead and there's nothing to lose. The only concern we might have is worrying about some of our dear friends and family members whom we've left behind. Siddhartha found these versions of the afterlife to be fantasies. Under close scrutiny, the typical vision of heaven is not that attractive, and neither is enlightenment. Retirement, honeymoons, and picnics are pleasing, but not if they're infinite. If our dream vacation lasts too long, we become nostalgic for home. If the perfect life contains no knowledge of suffering or risk, it can be boring. The moment you have the knowledge that these things exist, you have a choice, to be either condescending or filled with empathy toward those who suffer. That is not heavenly. Here in the mundane world, we can watch detective movies, thrillers, and erotic films. In heaven, you can't enjoy suggestive language or provocative clothing because if you're omniscient, you know what is behind it all. We can celebrate Friday night after a hard week at work. We can enjoy the change of seasons and install the latest software on our computers. We can open up the morning paper, read about all the unfortunate things happening in the world, and fantasize about what we would do if we could swap places with world leaders. All this despite the fact that many of our simple pleasures are really problems, not even in disguise. If you like watching football with a beer in your hand, then you are bound to watching the game for a full 2 hours and are not so free to do other things. You are vulnerable to interruptions. You must pay for the cable hookup and the groceries. Your cholesterol may go up, and you are at risk of having heart failure if the other team scores. By contrast, the enlightenment that we imagine is an unchanging, problem-free zone. Can we handle a state where there are no obstacles? We would have to do without many of the thrills, achievements, and entertainments that we believe constitute our happiness. Surely Eminem fans would get sick of all the harp music in heaven. They would want to hear his latest album with all of its offensive language. If we accept enlightenment as we've imagined, we wouldn't be able to enjoy suspense films. Our power of omniscience would ruin the surprise ending. There'd be no more excitement at the racetrack because we'd already know the winning horse. Immortality is another attribute commonly assigned to enlightenment or heaven. Once we arrive at our new home in the clouds, we will never die again, so we have no choice but to live on forever. We are stuck. There's no escape. We have everything we ever dreamed of except a way out, surprises, challenges, satisfactions, and free will, because we don't need it anymore. Taking all of this into consideration, from our present point of view, enlightenment is the ultimate state of boredom. But most of us don't critically examine our version of an afterlife. We prefer to keep it vague, with a general sense that it's a good, final resting place. The enlightenment we long for is forever, a sort of permanent residence. Or some may think they can come back for a visit as a sort of deity or higher being possessing special powers we mortals don't have. They would have angelic immunity, like a diplomat traveling on a special passport. and because of their immunity and high ranking, they think they will be able to arrange visas and shepherd their loved ones back with them. But then the question arises, if some of these new immigrants have their own set way of thinking, perhaps they like to wear certain conspicuous socks that distract other heavenly beings, won't heaven have a problem? And if all the good people are given membership to heaven or nirvana, whose version of happiness prevails? No matter how we define it, the ultimate goal of every being is happiness. It's no wonder that happiness is an indispensable part of the definition of heaven or enlightenment. A good afterlife should include finally getting what we've always strived for. Generally, in our personal version of heaven, we live in a system that is similar to our current system, except that it's more sophisticated and things work better. Happiness is not the goal. Most of us believe that the ultimate achievement on the spiritual path comes only after this life is over. We are stuck with these impure surroundings and bodies, and therefore we must die in order to fully succeed. Only after death will we experience the divine or enlightened state. So the best thing we can do in this life is prepare for it. What we do now will determine whether we go to heaven or to hell. Some people have already lost hope. They feel that they are inherently bad or evil and don't deserve to go to heaven. They are predestined for the netherworld. Similarly, many Buddhists know intellectually that everyone has the same potential and the same nature as Gautama Buddha, yet emotionally they feel they don't have the qualities or abilities to gain access to the golden gates of enlightenment, at least not in this life. For Siddhartha, the ultimate resting place of heaven or nirvana isn't a place at all. It's a release from the straitjacket of delusion. If you demand that a physical place be specified, then it can be where you're sitting right now. For Siddhartha, it was on top of a flat stone and some dried kusha grass under a Bodhi tree in the Indian state of Bihar. Anyone can visit that physical location, even today. Siddhartha's version of freedom is non-exclusive. It is attainable in this life, depending on the courage, wisdom, and diligence of the individual. There is no one who doesn't have this potential, including beings caught in the hell realms. It was not Siddhartha's aim to be happy. His path does not ultimately lead to happiness. Instead, it is a direct route to freedom from suffering, freedom from delusion and confusion. Thus, nirvana is neither happiness nor unhappiness. It goes beyond all such dualistic concepts. Nirvana is peace. Siddhartha's aim in teaching the Dharma is to completely free people like Jack, who suffers from fear of snakes. This means that Jack must go beyond the relief of realizing that he's in no danger from a snake. He must realize that there was never a snake to begin with, only a Giorgio Armani tie. In other words, Siddhartha's aim is to relieve Jack's suffering and then to help him realize that there was no inherently existing cause of suffering in the first place. We could say that simply understanding the truth brings about the attainment of enlightenment. To the extent that we understand the truth, we can progress through the stages of enlightenment called bodhisattva levels. If a child is frightened by a hideous monster at the theater, the fear can be alleviated by introducing the child to the actor out of costume backstage. Similarly, to the degree that you can see behind all phenomena and understand the truth, you are liberated. Even if the actor only takes off his mask, the fear is lessened. Likewise, if one partially understands the truth, there's an equivalent liberation. A sculptor may create a beautiful woman out of marble, but he should know better than to have passion toward his creation. Like Pygmalion with his statue of Galatea, we create our friends and our enemies as well, but we forget that it's so. Because of our lack of mindfulness, Our creations are transformed into something solid and real, and we become ever more entangled. When you fully realize, not just intellectually, that everything is just your creation, you will be free. Even though happiness is considered a mere concept, Buddhist texts still use terms like great bliss to describe enlightenment. Nirvana can indeed be understood as a joyful state, because having no confusion and no ignorance, no happiness and no unhappiness is bliss. Seeing the source of confusion and ignorance, the snake, for example, as never having existed is even better. You feel great relief when you awaken from a nightmare, but bliss would be never to have dreamed in the first place. In this sense, bliss is not the same as happiness. Siddhartha emphasized to his followers the futility of seeking peace and happiness in this world or in the afterlife, if they were serious about freeing themselves from samsara. The Trap of Happiness. Buddha had a cousin named Nanda who was deeply, passionately in love with one of his wives. They were obsessed with each other, inseparable, day or night. Buddha knew it was time for his cousin to wake up from this indulgence, so he went to Nanda's palace to beg for alms. Visitors were customarily turned away because Nanda was busy with lovemaking, but Buddha had special influence. For many lifetimes he had never told a lie, and because of this merit, he had earned the power of persuasive speech. When the guard delivered the message that Buddha was at the door, Nanda reluctantly got up from his love nest. He felt obligated to at least greet his cousin. Before he went out, his wife wet her thumb and traced a circle of saliva on his forehead, telling him that he must come back to her before it dried. But when Nanda went to offer alms, Buddha invited him to see something truly rare and fantastic. Nanda tried to find an excuse not to join the sightseeing tour, but Buddha insisted. The two journeyed to a mountain where many langurs dwelled, including one particularly gnarly one-eyed she-monkey. Buddha asked Nanda, "Who is more beautiful, your wife or this monkey?" Of course, Nanda replied that his wife was the most beautiful, and he described all her delights. Speaking of her made him realize that the spit on his forehead had long ago dried up, and he longed to return to his home. But instead, Buddha dragged Nanda to Tushita heaven, where hundreds of beautiful goddesses and mountains of heavenly wealth were on display. Buddha asked, "Who is more beautiful, your wife or these goddesses?" This time, Nanda bowed and replied that his wife was like a she-monkey compared to these goddesses. Buddha then showed Nanda an opulent throne that stood vacant amid all the treasures, goddesses, and guards. Awestruck, Nanda asked, "Who sits here?" Buddha told him to ask the goddesses. They said, "On earth, there is a man named Nanda who is soon going to become a monk. Because of his virtuous actions, he will be reborn in heaven and assume this throne so that we can serve him." Immediately, Nanda asked Buddha to ordain him. They returned to the mundane world, and Nanda became a monk. Buddha then summoned a second cousin, Ananda, and told him to make sure that all the other monks shunned Nanda. They were to avoid him at all costs. "Do not mingle, because you have different intentions. Therefore, your views are different, and your actions will, of course, be different," said Buddha. "You are looking for enlightenment, and he is looking for happiness." The monks avoided Nanda, who became sad and lonely. He spoke to Buddha about feeling left out. Buddha told Nanda to come with him again. This time, they journeyed to a hell realm, where they witnessed all kinds of torture, dismemberment, and asphyxiation. In the center of all the activity stood an enormous cauldron, with all the hell staff gathered around making grand preparations. Buddha told Nanda to ask what they were doing. "Oh," they replied, "on earth, there is a man named Nanda who is a monk now. Because of that, he will go to heaven for a long time. But because he hasn't cut the root of samsara, he will be too caught up with the enjoyments of the god realm and won't seek to generate more good circumstances. His merit will become exhausted, and he will fall straight into this cauldron so that we can boil him. At that moment, Nanda realized that he must renounce not only unhappiness, but happiness as well. Nanda's story illustrates how we all get caught up in pleasurable indulgences. Like Nanda, we are quick to forsake one happiness when a better happiness is presented. The one-eyed monkey reinforced Nanda's perception of his wife's supreme beauty, but he didn't hesitate to give her up when he saw the goddesses. If enjoyment were merely happiness, then it too could be discerned when something better comes along. Happiness is a flimsy premise upon which to base one's life. We human beings tend to think of enlightened beings within our own context. It's easier to imagine a hypothetical enlightened being off in the hazy distance rather than a present, living, breathing enlightened being, because in our mind such a being must be spectacular, possessing superior traits and talents in addition to all the best human characteristics. Some of us may think we can gain enlightenment by trying really hard. But with such an exalted image in our minds, trying hard probably means exerting ourselves and sacrificing all kinds of goodies for millions of lifetimes. These thoughts may arise when we bother to think about it, but most of the time we can't be bothered. It's too tiring. When we see how difficult it is to get rid of our mundane habits, enlightenment seems out of reach. If I can't even stop smoking, how can I think about stopping the habits of passion, anger, and denial? Many of us think that we must appoint someone like a savior or a guru to do the cleansing for us because we don't have confidence to do it alone. But all this pessimism isn't necessary if we have the right information about the truth of interdependence and a little bit of discipline to apply it. Hope and primordial purity. Enlightenment transcends doubt, just as knowledge gained through experience transcends doubt. We must come to a complete understanding that the defilements and confusions that obstruct our enlightenment are not fixed in place. As stubborn and permanent-seeming as our obstacles may be, they are actually unstable, compounded phenomena. Understanding the logic that compounded phenomena are dependent and can be manipulated leads us to see their impermanent nature and to reach the conclusion that they can be completely removed. Our true nature is like a wine glass, and our defilements and obscurations are like dirt and fingerprints. When we buy the glass, it has no inherently existing fingerprints. When it becomes soiled, the habitual mind thinks the glass is dirty, not that the glass has dirt. Its nature is not dirty. It's a glass with some dirt and fingerprints on it. These impurities can be removed. If the glass is dirty, then the only option is to get rid of the glass itself, because the dirt and the glass would be united into one thing, a dirty glass. But that is not the case. The dirt, fingerprints, and other substances appeared on the glass due to a number of circumstances. They are temporary. We can use all kinds of different methods to wash the dirt away. We can wash the glass in the river, or the sink, or the dishwasher, or we can ask the maid to clean it. But no matter what method we use, the intent is to remove the dirt, not the glass. There is a big distinction between washing the glass and washing the dirt. We might contend that it's just a semantic distinction, that when we say we are washing the dishes, we mean that we are washing the impurities off of the dishes. And in that case, Siddhartha would agree. But if we think that the glass is somehow different than it was before, there's a misconception. Because the glass has no inherent fingerprints. When you remove the dirt, the glass isn't transformed. It's the same glass you bought at the store. When we think of ourselves as inherently angry and ignorant, and we doubt our ability to achieve enlightenment, we are thinking that our true nature is permanently impure and defiled. But like the fingerprints on the wine glass, these emotions are not part of our true nature. We have only gathered pollutants from all sorts of unfavorable situations, such as associating with non-virtuous people or not understanding the consequences of our actions. The primordial absence of defilements, the pure nature of the self, is often called Buddha nature. Yet the defilements and the resulting emotions have been there for so long and have become so strong that they are our second nature, always shadowing us. It's not surprising that we think there's no hope. To regain hope, those on the Buddhist path may start out thinking, "My wine glass can be cleaned," or "My being can be purified of negativity." This is the same slightly naive way of looking at the situation as Jack thinking that the snake must be removed. Nevertheless, sometimes it is a necessary preparatory step before we can see the primordial true nature of things. If it is not possible to perceive the pre-existing purity of all phenomena, at least believing that a pure state can be attained helps drive us forward. Like Jack wanting to get rid of the snake, we want to rid ourselves of obscurations, and we have the courage to try because we know it's possible. We must simply apply remedies to weaken the causes and conditions of our defilements or strengthen their opposition. For example, by generating love and compassion to conquer anger. Just as our enthusiasm for doing the dishes comes from trusting we can have a clean glass, our enthusiasm for eliminating our obscurations comes from trusting we have Buddha nature. We have the confidence to put our dirty dishes in the dishwasher because we know that the food is removable. If we were asked to wash charcoal and make it white, we would not have such enthusiasm and confidence. Flashing through the stormy darkness. But how does one detect Buddha nature in the midst of so much ignorance, darkness, and confusion? The first sign of hope for sailors lost at sea is to catch sight of a beam of light flashing through the stormy darkness. Navigating toward it, they come to the source of the light, the lighthouse. Love and compassion are like the light emanating from Buddha nature. Initially, Buddha nature is a mere concept beyond our view, but if we generate love and compassion, we can eventually move toward it. It may be difficult to see the Buddha nature in those who are lost in the darkness of greed, hate, and ignorance. Their Buddha nature is so distant, we might think it is non-existent. But even within the darkest and most violent people, there are flashes of love and compassion, however brief and faint. If these rare glimpses are attended to, and if energy is invested to move in the direction of the light, their Buddha nature can be uncovered. For this reason, love and compassion are praised as the safest path to the total absence of ignorance. Siddhartha's first act of compassion took place during an early incarnation in an unlikely place, not as a bodhisattva, but as a resident of a hell realm where he found himself as the result of his own bad karma. He and a fellow hell being were forced to drag a chariot through the hellfires while a demon master rode in back, whipping them mercilessly. Siddhartha was still quite strong, but his companion was very weak and was being targeted even more viciously because of it. The sight of his companion being whipped sent a pang of compassion through Siddhartha. He begged the demon, "Please let him go. Let me carry the burden for both of us." Enraged, the demon bashed Siddhartha's head in, and Siddhartha died, to be reincarnated in a higher realm. That spark of compassion at the point of death continued to grow and become brighter in his later reincarnations. Along with love and compassion, there are myriad paths available to bring us closer to realizing Buddha nature. Even if we only intellectually understand the basic goodness of ourselves and all beings, this understanding brings us closer to accomplishment. It is as if we have misplaced a precious diamond ring, but at least we know it's inside our treasure chest, not lost on some vast mountainside. Although we use words such as achieving, wishing, and praying for enlightenment, ultimately, we don't acquire enlightenment from an external source. A more correct way to put it is discovering the enlightenment that has always been there. Enlightenment is part of our true nature. Our true nature is like a golden statue. However, it is still in its mold, which is like our defilements and ignorance. Because ignorance and emotion are not an inherent part of our nature, just as the mold is not part of the statue, there is such a thing as primordial purity. When the mold is broken, the statue emerges. When our defilements are removed, our true Buddha nature is revealed. But it's important to understand that Buddha nature is not a divine, truly existing soul or essence. How does it feel? We might still wonder, what is this enlightenment if it is not happiness or unhappiness? How does an enlightened being appear and function? How does it feel to discover our Buddha nature? In Buddhist texts, when these questions are posed, the answer is usually that it's beyond our conception, inexpressible. Many seem to have misunderstood this as a sly way of not answering the question, but actually that is the answer. Our logic, language, and symbols are so limited, we cannot even fully express something so mundane as the sense of relief. Words are inadequate to fully transmit the total experience of relief to another person. If even quantum physicists find it difficult to find words to express their theories, then how can we expect to find a vocabulary for enlightenment? While we are caught in our current state, where only a limited amount of logic and language is used, and where emotions still grip us, we can only imagine what it's like to be enlightened. But sometimes, with diligence and inferential logic, we can get a good approximation. Just as when you see smoke coming from a mountain peak, you can make a calculated guess that there's a fire. Using what we have, we can begin to see and accept that obscurations are due to causes and conditions that can be manipulated and ultimately cleansed. Imagining the absence of our defiled emotions and negativity is the first step to understanding the nature of enlightenment. Suppose you are suffering from a headache. Your immediate wish is for relief, which is possible because you recognize that the headache is not part of your innate being. Next, you try to determine what caused the headache, lack of sleep, for example. Then, you apply the proper remedy to remove the headache, such as taking aspirin or lying down for a nap. In his first sermon at Varanasi, Siddhartha taught the following four steps, known popularly as the Four Noble Truths. Know the suffering, abandon the causes of suffering, apply the path to the cessation of suffering, know that suffering can end. Some might wonder why Siddhartha needed to point out, know the suffering. Aren't we intelligent enough to know when we are in pain? Unfortunately, only when pain is in its most fully blossomed state do we recognize it as pain and suffering. It's difficult to convince someone who is blissfully licking an ice cream cone that he's suffering. But then he remembers his doctor's warning to lower his cholesterol and lose weight. And if you explore this seeming pleasure closely from the time he started craving ice cream all the way to his worry about fat and cholesterol, you will see that it's been an anxious time. It's easy to accept that emotions such as anger can be controlled with the proper remedy, perhaps for one afternoon, but it's mentally challenging to accept that an emotion can disappear forever. If we can imagine someone who has partially removed anger, generally appearing calm and tranquil, we can take it a step further and imagine a person who has permanently removed anger. But how does someone who has gone beyond all emotions behave? The blindly devoted might imagine some docile being, perhaps sitting cross-legged on a cloud. The skeptics, however, may think that this person must function like a vegetable, unresponsive and dull, if he even exists at all. Even though the enlightened state is inexpressible, and enlightened beings cannot be identified by the ordinary mind, we can still ask, who was Siddhartha? What did he do that was so amazing and so powerful? What extraordinary feats did he perform? In Buddhism, an enlightened being is not judged by supernatural acts such as flying or by physical attributes such as a third eye. Even though Buddha is frequently described as looking very serene, golden in color, with gentle hands and a regal manner, these descriptions appeal primarily to naive peasants and jack-like beings. In the strict Buddhist scriptures, Buddha's ability to fly and to perform magic are not flaunted. In fact, time and again in the pith instructions, Buddha's followers are warned not to be impressed by these inconsequential traits. Although he may have possessed such talents, they were never considered his greatest achievements. His greatest achievement was understanding the truth, because it is the understanding of the truth that frees us from suffering once and for all. That is the true miracle. Buddha saw the same old age and sickness and death that we see, but he was driven to find the root causes, and that, too, is a miracle. His realization that all compounded things are impermanent was his ultimate triumph. Instead of flaunting victory over some externally existing enemy, he found that the real enemy is our clinging to the self, and defeating that self-clinging is a miracle far greater than all supernatural miracles, real or imagined. Although modern scientists can take credit for discovering that time and space are relative, Siddhartha came to the same conclusion 2,500 years ago, without any research grants or scientific laboratories, and that, too, is a miracle. Unlike many of his contemporaries, and like many of us today, who were stuck with the notion that our freedom depends on the grace of others, he discovered that every being is by nature pure. Equipped with this knowledge, all beings have the power to free themselves. Instead of retreating into a lifetime of contemplation, Buddha had the incredible compassion to share his breakthrough discoveries with all beings, no matter how difficult to teach and to understand. He designed a path with tens of thousands of methods, from simple ones like offering incense, sitting straight, and watching the breath, to complex visualizations and meditations. This was his extraordinary power. The advantages of going beyond space and time. When Siddhartha became enlightened, he became known as the Buddha. Buddha isn't a person's name, it is the label for a state of mind. The word Buddha is defined as one quality with two aspects, accomplished one and awakened one. In other words, one who has purified defilements and one who has attained knowledge. Through his realization under the Bodhi tree, Buddha awoke from the dualistic state that is mired in concepts such as subject and object. He realized that nothing compounded can permanently exist. He realized that no emotion leads one to bliss if it stems from clinging to ego. He realized that there is no truly existing self and no truly existing phenomena to be perceived. And he realized that even enlightenment is beyond concepts. These realizations are what we call Buddha's wisdom, an awareness of the whole truth. Buddha is referred to as omniscient. That doesn't mean that Buddha went to every university in the world and memorized every book. Such study does not equate to awakened knowledge, for it is a dualistic knowledge which is based on objects and subjects and bound by its own limitations, rules, and goals. As we can clearly see, with all the scientific knowledge we have today, the world hasn't improved. In fact, it may even be worse. To be omniscient doesn't mean to be learned. Thus, to speak of someone who knows everything means someone who has no not knowing and no ignorance. Buddha went a step further and pointed out the truth of the awakened mind to others so that they too could break the cycle of suffering, and for this compassion he is most revered. If someone is unknowingly about to walk through a field of landmines, we might be able to quickly defuse the mines without letting him know. But that only protects the person temporarily, and it doesn't provide the complete truth. To explain to him that there are landmines in that direction for several miles saves him from both immediate and future suffering. It allows him to go forward and even share the knowledge with others. In the same way, Buddha taught people to be generous if they wish to be rich, and to be compassionate if they wish to conquer their enemies. But he also advised that if they want to be rich, first be content. If they want to conquer the enemy, first conquer their own anger. Ultimately, he taught that suffering can be cut at the root by dismantling the self. For if there is no self, there is no sufferer. In appreciation for his teachings, Siddhartha's followers venerated him with songs and prayers in which he is praised for being so powerful that he could put the entire universe on top of one atom. With similar reverence, some followers wish to be reborn in the realm called the Buddha Field. The Buddha Field is described as a pure land the size of one infinitesimal particle, upon which the same number of Buddhas as there are atoms in the universe teach their own disciples. As with Milarepa's yak horn, a non-believer can read this as a religious fairy tale, whereas a believer might uncritically accept the description, thinking, of course Buddha can do this, he's omnipotent. But if we can think of the truth in terms of emptiness, realizing that there is no such thing as smallest and biggest, or any other dualistic distinctions, then it's clear that Buddha did not need muscle and brawn to pick up the world and place it on an atom. The very understanding that there is no big or small was all the force necessary. It is possible to remove the habit that prevents us from seeing in this way, but our limited logic gets in the way. We are like an anorexic or bulimic who, even though she may be beautiful and slender, simply cannot accept what she sees in the mirror, even while others can't see why she thinks she is fat. Buddha removed all such obfuscations and saw everything, time, space, gender, values, to be absent of dualism, so the universe could rest on a single atom. For this realization, his poetic devotees praised him for going beyond space and time. Even Siddhartha's closest disciples, the arhats, are renowned for seeing the sky and the palm of a hand as the same size.